everyone. This is Free Food for Thought, a student-run, student-focused podcast here to feed your curiosity. I'm Joelle.
And I'm Daniela. And today we're sitting down with Elizabeth Farfan Santos, who has a PhD and master's in medical anthropology from the University of California, Berkeley. An accomplished researcher and scholar, Farfan Santos is the author of two books, Black Bodies, Black Rights, The Politics of Quilombolismo in Contemporary Brazil and Undocumented Motherhood, Conversations on Love, Trauma, and Border Crossing. Her work has appeared in prestigious journals including Medical Anthropology, Cross-Cultural Studies in Health and Illness, Latino Studies, and the Journal of Latin American and Caribbean Anthropology.
All right, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So our first question is about your recent book. And so I'm wondering how the study of motherhood, how has it taught you about the people who raised you?
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you for such a nice introduction. I'm really excited to be talking to students specifically. My recent book is Undocumented Motherhood, and it was just published just this last November. I was doing a lot of research on undocumented immigrants, and particularly I was interested in their access to medical services and healthcare. It was a time when I started the research, it was a time when we were right in the middle of a pretty major healthcare reform, the Affordable Care Act, under the Obama administration. And notably, undocumented immigrants were specifically excluded from any kind of participation in those reforms. So I was initially interested in just understanding how that specific exclusion, because it was the only group of people that was specifically excluded and very, very vocally highlighted as being excluded from the policy. I was interested in how people were receiving that and what that meant to people. And primarily because growing up, we grew up using public medical resources. And so we grew up on CHIP and Medicaid and WIC, which is a Women, Infants, and Children's program, which offers kind of assistance in kind of formula, you know, those kind of food for a infant child. You know, my mother is an undocumented, but my father was, and I had several family members who were undocumented. But my family is very much, I am Mexican American, born and raised in Texas, but my family is an immigrant family. So I grew up in a very immigrant cultural household, Mexican cultural household, despite having been born here. The topic of access to healthcare is very, very, I'm very passionate about that topic. It's very important to me. Obviously the topic of, immigration is very important to me because of my family. So I was already, thinking about my family members before I even started. And that tends to be the underlying current in my work. My work is very personal. It's very much about things that are that are part of my communities. And so even my work in Brazil, which isn't about, my racial or ethnic community, is about identity formation and how and authenticity and how people find belonging and are accepted or not accepted as members of a community because of their kind of historical trajectory or their racial ethnic trajectory. And so even that kind of comes back to an experience that is shared by undocumented immigrants and immigrants in the United States. And so I already kind of brought this personal aspect to it. So the work then became a project of not only understanding the main character in the book, whose name is Claudia in the story. So the book follows Claudia's life as an undocumented mother, primarily her experience crossing the border and then trying to find healthcare resources for her hearing impaired daughter, Natalia. The listening to her story and then afterward reflecting on her story really brought up memories of my own mother's experience, my grandmother's experience, stories I had heard from women in my family. One thing that is a big part of my life, and I talk about it in the book as kind of my chapter, capital letter chapter in my book and in my life is when, you know, I went to live with my grandmother in Mexico. My brother and I went to live with my grandmother in Mexico, and we lived there for several years when we were really young. And a few of those years we were apart from my mother because she had to stay in the United States and work. And I remember that time in my life very fondly because it really strengthened my relationship to my grandmother. And you know, we were best friends, you know, and so it was, that's how I remembered it. It was fun. It was, you know, when I was with my grandmother, and there's lots of funny memories and things like that. But when I was listening to Claudia and she was really feeling very deeply about some of the decisions that she had to make when she crossed the border, primarily all the times that she had to leave Nati behind, that they weren't together because of the border crossing, right? She did what she had to do. And she was so worried about, one, she was reflecting on, oh my God, you know, all of the things that, like we do often, right? We think back and like, oh my God, so many things could have happened differently. You know, there's so many ways that I could potentially not be here today, you know, if something else had happened. And that, I think that was going through her mind as she was talking. But then she was also thinking, what is she gonna think? Like, did I traumatize her for life? And this is such a parent feeling, you know, when you're a parent, we're constantly feeling like, am I traumatizing my child by doing this? You know, and we're trying to, especially this generation, I think we're trying to break generational traumas and we're trying not to create new ones. And it's really hard. So there are these very particular aspects of Claudia's experience that are related to her being an undocumented mother and just to her being Claudia and, you know, her own unique self and her own unique life. But there are these also these kind of connecting universal feelings, right, that as a mother I connected to, as a daughter I connected to. So I was kind of having these two reactions at the same time. I was thinking about my mother and I was thinking about wow, I never thought about what she may have felt like leaving us, you know, not being with us, you know. It was always just from my perspective. And, you know, there were times in my life when I even felt a little bit resentful and angry, you know, that we didn't have that time together. I really do feel like it made an impact on our relationship, and sad about it. And so, you know, seeing Claudia and seeing her cry and having to kind of really reckon with her emotions and being witness her emotions forced me to see my mother as more than just my mother and see her as a human being, right? As a woman, as a person that made hard choices, and then ultimately decided to interview her as well, to kind of let me get her perspective. Let me find out what was really going on. And it became a little bit of a healing journey for us as well.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much.
So when dealing with such powerful emotional stories like Claudia's, how does that translate into your medical anthropology research?
Yeah. So as a medical anthropologist, you know, our primary focus is thinking about how we think about our bodies. And so it is about how we think about health and illness, but more so it's about how we've kind of conceptualized our physical bodies and in that how we think about ourselves as either being healthy or sick, and then how we interact with those things, how we perform healthiness and or illness, and how we interact with, you know, healthcare systems, right, or our medical leaders, right, whether they are doctors, Western doctors, or other kinds of healers, right. So, you know, and that's fascinating for me because I think there are different types of anthropology. And this is where I would normally go on a tangent into all the types of anthropology, but I won't do that. There are different types of anthropology. And I really believe that medical anthropology kind of encompasses all of it because we're thinking about cultural experiences and cultural life, but we're also thinking about the somatic, the physical body, right? And how, you know, and that as a presence in itself as well, not just kind of the symbolic, but the physical body. So this was really, I think, important and interesting and in my work, because as Claudia is telling me her story, you know, she's just telling me her memories, just like when you're sitting with a friend and you're telling your story, you're talking about your life. But I'm putting it's like I'm putting a puzzle together. You know, I'm putting the pieces together. And every topic that we covered was a different day of interview. So we would go, I would go and I would ask about something specific. So, you know, for a lot of my research, I wasn't able to get mothers to talk so much about themselves as because they wanted to talk more about their children and their experience, their children's experiences with the healthcare, with their health. And so it took me several interviews before I was able to get to a day. And I kept letting her know. I kept saying, you know, okay, on, you know, this day, we're talking about your health. I'm just letting you know it's going to be about you. And so I had to keep kind of warming her up to that. And I think where the medical anthropology comes in is that, you know, I start connecting the dots, right? So, you know, earlier she was telling me about her immigration story, and now she's telling me about her dealing with fibromyalgia and uterine cancers and kind of uterine diseases. And, you know, I'm going back and she doesn't have a lot of information on where this stuff came from. The doctors aren't able to tell her why she has fibromyalgia or why she has these persistent cysts in her uterus. You know, that could have kind of led to cervical cancer. And, you know, so I'm researching it, and so much of it is related to trauma. And it could be any kind of trauma. I mean, it could be a sudden and immediate trauma. It could be psychological. It can be physical. And I'm going through the notes and I'm like, well, she's had so many psychological and physical traumas, you know, just crossing the border and all of the things that she experienced on the border. I mean, that absolutely has an impact on the body. And so when I'm, as a medical anthropologist, when I'm hearing these stories, I'm hearing them as more than just memories, as more than just experiences. I'm also hearing them as how does that impact your body? How has that been absorbed into the physical body, and now it's coming out? What is it coming out as? And what are the different manifestations of trauma in the physical realm, right? And potentially through illness. So just as there are forms of resilience and strength that come out of these experiences, you know, the body also holds on to that in a lot of different ways. And so once I started kind of going through the story and really going through what she was saying about fibromyalgia and then doing research on, you know, where these, what some of the symptoms were and what doctors kind of believe that those may be related to, I was able to kind of put those pieces together, which is something that she hadn't necessarily thought about.
I'm really interested in this kind of idea of trauma in healthcare, because I know that I read that you teach doctors anthropology, and I thought that was so interesting. And I guess I'm kind of wondering, you know, your largest critiques to kind of the privatization of healthcare in the United States and maybe some specific harms that affect immigrants coming into the United States.
Yeah, that's such a great question, and something I'm really passionate about. You know, I think that it's really unfortunate and violent that we don't have universal health care in the United States. One of the things that I always preface my work, I usually preface my research by saying, you know, healthcare and immigration have so much in common, you know, because these are things that are related to, they're human, they're fundamentally human needs, right? And so we think about migration. Migration is a human right, and it's a human necessity, you know. I mean, if we aren't able to migrate, if we aren't able to move around, it's such a fundamental part of our rights. We take it for granted, you know. Many of us are fortunate to be in very comfortable, are privileged to be in very comfortable situations where we're not thinking about, you know, I need to leave for the safety of my family, right? And we're not thinking about the freedom, the fact that we have the freedom to do that for the most part, until that freedom is threatened, right? And so just, I won't go on a tangent on this, but just to kind of give a specific example, there was a lot of different ways in which that freedom of movement was being threatened with the abortion laws that were coming into place, right? And so the ability for a woman potentially from Texas, from a very authoritarian state like the one I come from, to California, to be able to get access to reproductive health resources, you know, there were considerations on not allowing that or even tracking that women's movement, right? And that's, you know, there were some representatives that said, hey, you know, it's a fundamental right that people can move between states. And so that's something that we take for granted, but that can very easily be taken away. And so migration is fundamentally human, and the need for healthcare, because we are all organic, you know, bodies. And so our bodies are going to get sick. They're going to break down. They're going to need care. And so that really brings these two things bring us together as human beings, which is why I love talking about these things, because I think that we can all connect to them, right, fundamentally. And so, you know, the fact that that healthcare is privatized in the United States, that even with the Affordable Care Act, specifically with a lot of the changes that happened after Obama's presidency, you know, people really, you really have to have healthcare out of your job. You have to be employed to have, you know, some kind of quality healthcare that's somewhat affordable. And even then, it's not, you know, I mean, even then people have deductibles. I mean, how ridiculous is it that you pay, let's say you have a normal copay, you know, monthly payment of $500 to $600 a month for a healthcare plan, and then you still have a $10,000 deductible that, you know, that you have to pay before you can even see the doctor, you know, and then, you know, maybe you don't have pharmaceutical assistance, and so then your medications cost more. God forbid you have a chronic illness, you know, that requires you to go to the doctor over and over again and to have specialized care, major procedures, MRIs, et cetera, that costs money even, you know, outside of your insurance. And so I think that, you know, one of the things that was so interesting about the Affordable Care Act reform that President Obama had said was, you know, in the United States, people should have the health security. You know, he was very focused on health security, which meant that you knew that that at least you knew that if you got sick, you'd be taken care of. And before the Affordable Care Act, it was a lot worse. You know, the majority of the American population did not have access to health insurance, and even the people that did, because at that time insurance companies were just running rampant, and it was absurd. There was no control. There's a lot more control. As much as it doesn't seem like it's better, and it seems like it's still terrible, it is better than it was, but it's still bad. And, you know, we are a country that, because we have privatized care, we spend more of our GDP on healthcare than any other country, any other developed country, and yet we have worse healthcare outcomes. You know, we have a lower life expectancy than most developed nations. So we actually die younger than people in other countries of similar GDP. And so we're not better for it. You know, we're not. And so it really is, even now, I think people who don't have insurance share a lot of the people who are uninsured share similar experiences to undocumented immigrants in that case. I mean, undocumented immigrants, when it comes to the healthcare system, they really are just uninsured patients. You know, the difference is that if you're uninsured and you're an American citizen, then, you know, potentially you might have access to, you know, some public health resources. In California, certainly Medicaid was expanded, and so more people have access to Medicaid. You know, in Texas, it wasn't expanded, so hardly anybody has access to Medicaid. I mean, you really, any adult, really, it's just children, but I mean, it's pretty much nobody has access to that. And so, you know, there's a little bit more, but there's still not. And so what do you do? You know, we have two, in Houston, we have two public hospitals. And that's where everybody who's uninsured is. And Texas is one of the most uninsured states in the nation. And so you have a wait time of, you know, days potentially, you know, and they're only, you know, if you're coming in with maybe a firearm wound or a car accident or something, you know, where you can be seen quickly by the emergency room. Otherwise, you know, you could be there for days. You know, this is not making us, we're with the pandemic, we're dealing with illness so much more now. It seems like we're constantly dealing with illness now. It feels like we're sick all the time. And so what does that do? It doesn't make you a more productive person. You're sick, you're tired, you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, and then on top of that, you don't have the security of knowing if something big happens, you know, you could, the fact that you could lose your entire livelihood if you get sick in the United States is incredibly violent. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess a lot of your work deals with social determinants of health in very emotional ways. And I guess I want to learn more about kind of the way you want to present your research through story and through writing and in a more artistic way than you normally would find medically based mm-hmm. research. So kind of what inspires that and how do you formulate your projects?
Yeah, so the majority of my research prior to the book was very much geared toward public health leaders in an attempt to try to at least improve interactions with the undocumented community. One of the things that I write really passionately and strongly about is what I call kind of living barriers to health. And so, you know, there's these social determinants and in public health, we talk a lot about barriers to access. And a lot of times these are things like policies and, policies, people's income, these kinds of, you know, very hard things that if you kind of put them all together, it feels very overwhelming, like nothing can be done. I mean, they're barriers, they're there, there's always going to be racism, sexism, you know, these kinds of things are going to exist. And I think, you know, when people are just focused on the policies and on these kind of economic and structural barriers, it can be really depressing. And, you know, there's not a lot of hope a lot of times, especially when you're trying really hard to get better leaders and to kind of protest and make things happen. And it doesn't feel like it's happening, right? Especially in these political climates. and so, when I talk about living barriers, I talk about the everyday lived experience of interacting with the healthcare system. And I talk about how, you know, yes, structures are, you know, there are structural barriers, social barriers, legal, political. At the same time, these are created and implemented by people. Right. And, you know, a lot of times, for example, a politician, and this is why they use discourse very specifically and intentionally, because a politician even just saying something can turn it into policy if the people in that clinic or in that hospital, the people that are actually running that space, decide that they want to implement it, they can do whatever they want. I mean, when you're interacting one-on-one with somebody and you're talking about somebody who's fundamentally and historically disenfranchised and marginalized, like an undocumented immigrant, who may not know, right, if this is actually the truth or not, you know, and they just kind of take it for granted, right? And so I talk a lot about those interactions and how those human interactions are really what creates the on-the-ground experience. Also, going back to what I was saying about the Affordable Care Act, well, when undocumented immigrants were excluded from the policy, it was symbolic. It didn't really matter. Undocumented immigrants have been excluded from healthcare resources since the 90s. And so, you know, this is not that was not something new, but it was important that it was very vocal and very verbal as a symbolic statement of what it means to be a citizen. You as a citizen are special. Those people can't take your resources. Why? Because the discourse around undocumented immigrants is that they're stealing resources. They're coming here to steal our jobs, to steal our resources, all of these things, our education, our healthcare, all of these things, right? And so that's what that language is for, right? And so even just that language already has an impact on the ground, regardless of whether it's a political reality or anything's actually changing. And so it's so much about the personal. It's so much about interactions. It's so much about that receptionist at the front desk. So when I work with doctors, this is why it's so great to work with doctors, because what I teach them is, or medical students, what I teach them is, you know, there's this whole marathon that your patients are running before they even get to you. And they may not even make it, because just like in a marathon, they may get tired halfway. Somebody may be there to give them water and snacks to help them keep going, or somebody may be there to push them down, like literally push them on the ground. And there's that difference, right, of that person giving them water for them to finish, for them to actually get to inside your clinic and in front of you. Right. It is for anybody. And this, I think, where my personal experience comes from, too. For anybody who has dealt with the public health system, you know that it's exhausting, you know, especially if you don't have a car and you have to take the bus to your appointments. You're taking your mother to appointments and you're taking time off of work, taking time off of school. You're having to bring your kids, take your kids out of school to go to the doctor. It costs you money. There's all this paperwork you have to fill out and you don't understand any of it. People are yelling at you all the time because people are not always very friendly in those spaces. I mean, this is something that came out in my research, that a lot of times when folks were going to the doctor, they just felt humiliated. You know, they were often patronized and just yelled at, right? Because they didn't bring the right documents again, because I told you to bring the check stub and again you didn't bring the check stub. And this person doesn't even, there was a woman that I was, or a community health worker that I was interviewing, and she had a patient that it was her second or third time coming, and she still didn't have her pay stubs. And she said, let me just ask her, you know, let me find out what's going on. So she asks her and finds out that she wasn't bringing the pay stubs, because the pay stubs were online and she didn't know how to log online. She didn't understand the program. It was a new program, so she didn't know how to do it. And so she was bringing something and she thought that's what it was, and it wasn't. So the community health worker sat with her, and it took her 5 minutes to go on the website and print them out for her. And, you know, she said, I did that for her because she takes the bus and she takes time off of work, and every time she has to come, and they can't do that all the time. And so, you know, that person, that one community health worker really, really helped somebody in that moment. And it didn't matter what all the policies were. She helped that woman get access that day. And that's what, at the end of the day, that's what that woman needed, right? And so there are so many ways that we can make changes in our there's so much hope. I mean, if there are people who can create barriers, then there are also those of us who can break those down. And sometimes it requires breaking the rules, honestly, because the rules, as we know, are not always right. I mean, the rules have enslaved people and, you know, done all kinds of horrible things. And so, yes, there are consequences to those actions. But can we make changes? Yes, we can. So we don't have to be hopeless and overwhelmed by these policies and policymakers that are fighting over whether or not we can access TikTok, right? You know, and we're distracted with these things. We can make changes on the ground and fundamentally impact and change people's lives, even if it's just one person. So it was important for me to write this book then, after kind of speaking to public health leaders, to kind of speak to kind of everyone, really, for people to be able to connect to the women in the book, and to undocumented immigrants and immigrants in their community at a human level, at the level of the human, not just the policy, not just, you know, those kinds of structural things, but, you know, as a human being, like I said, there are all of these underlying experiences and feelings that we share. They're not the same. We're not the same, but we've felt things like this. We have felt terror for the health of a sick child. You know, as a parent, having a child with 102 degree fever in the middle of the night is it's terrifying, right? And regardless of whether you're an undocumented mother or a citizen, or, you know, it's the same feeling, right? And so there are feelings that we can connect to. And so it's important for the book to bring out that emotive aspect of these experiences for there to be more human connection. And so it was important for me to be vulnerable in the story so that I could model that for the reader. You know, you can't fake that, you know, the vulnerability, I think, has to go both ways in order for there to be permission for a reader to be vulnerable and for a reader to interact with the book in a different way other than just kind of in this detached, you know, from this detached space of absolute, you know, incommensurable difference.
So we do have just enough time for one more question. And I was wondering if you could share a quote from your book that you think our listeners should kind of definitely notice and keep with them.
Oh, yes, I do actually. Okay, so this is from the introduction or the preface. It says, "Mothers are supposed to sacrifice their own future for their children's future, but even sacrifice is political and fundamentally shaped by race, class, and political status. Immigrant mothers, especially those who migrate without formal papers, are judged very differently for their sacrifices. Fleeing across the U.S.-Mexico border to protect their children's lives and future is not often dignified as a selfless act of maternal love, but rather charged as a selfish and criminal act, a crime punishable by state-sanctioned family separation and detention. The result is that immigrant mothers often feel compounding guilt and torment over the sacrifices they had to make during their migration. This guilt and pain, buried in their bodies, bleeds through their testimonios and sits in the silent, unspoken, unseen, and thus undocumented parts of their medical histories."
With that, thank you so much for joining us today, Professor. It was amazing to speak with you, and to our listeners, stay hungry.